Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted you could join me today as I welcome back a great guest, Dr. William Lee, author of the bestseller, How to Beat Your Diet. Now, Dr. Lee is a huge believer in food as medicine, and he has the medical and science background to back those beliefs up. We had a fabulously enlightening conversation when he joined me on the show a few weeks ago, but there was so much more I wanted to talk with him about that I asked him to join me again, and here he is, with more on the science behind eating your way to a healthy metabolism. Now, a surprising chapter in the book, to me at least, is about the way of Bruce Lee. And I asked Dr. Lee to explain what that's all about.
All right. Well, many people know who Bruce Lee is. He was a martial artist that brought Chinese kung fu and martial arts to the world main stage in the early 1970s in a series of movies that really have become classics in the sort of the action genre. And pretty much any action movie you see now that has kicking and punching and martial arts really has an origin back to him. When I was a kid, I really idolized Bruce Lee. He was sort of like a hero for me as somebody who had Asian immigrant parents. He was a Chinese American, and the things that he stood for, which is, you know, against bullying, about independence, and about sort of ethnic pride, I really felt those were important values to me. His physical skills were amazing. And so I always looked forward to developing my own physical skills like Bruce Lee. But actually, as an adult, what I came to realize, is that his philosophy is so profound. His philosophy, and he studied philosophy as a college student in America, was really about individualism, which is something that's so important to us and so timely still today, that we are all individuals, and yet we have this sort of unity as humans. And so how do you actually respect traditions that might make each of us different from one another, one group different from one another? And yet, how do we actually celebrate our individuality within those groups and between those groups? And as it relates to health, you know, here it is, you know, I wrote a book called Eat to Beat Your Diet. And the reason that that's not a diet book, but an anti-diet book, is really because when you think about goals like weight loss or beautification, you know, preparing for the summertime, everyone sort of wants to find that simple one formula that you can slavishly follow and come out the other end looking amazing and feeling amazing. And the reality is that that doesn't exist. Every individual has their own body, their own preferences, their own background. And what we all need to do, and this is what I write about in my book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, we need to adapt the best principles that have been developed from different areas of science, whether it's food as medicine, whether it's intermittent fasting, whether it's taking a look at our sleep, whether it's looking at our lifestyle, other aspects of our lifestyle, and indeed, whether it's looking at modern medicine for diagnosis and treatment, and even reversal disease. All those very complex factors become individualized. And so what I wrote about my book is, as an anti-diet book, if you don't want to become, and you don't want to become a slave to a diet that you can't sustain, how do you take principles that I write about and apply them in a way that's true to you? And so that's why I sort of talked about kind of the way of Bruce Lee informing us as somebody who really had a gigantic impact in so many areas. And by the way, these ideas of individualism and that adaptation and resilience and training and continuous learning, these are now not just practiced by sports enthusiasts, but in fact, some of the Bruce Lee principles are also used in business training as well for executives. And so I think that, you know, what I realized is that if I'm going to write this book, I was going to have a little bit of fun, but also very authentic translation of a powerful figure in history whose teachings and whose ideas still have profound impact on our health today.
I think it's fantastic. And I am always saying to people, it has to be your individual needs that are looked after, not some slavish diet that says if you eat so many pounds of this over so many days, you will lose so many pounds in weight. You know, that kind of idea. Absolutely. So I think that was brilliant. I think it's fantastic that you brought Bruce Lee into it. A fantastic role model, in fact. And, you know, there was so much that I wanted to talk to you about last time. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you more about was organics, organic food. Wow. Now, you say that until recently, you didn't really, you know, you were neither here nor there when it came to organic. You didn't really think it was that important. And now you've changed your mind.
Yeah. So when the organic movement, food movement first came out, I thought, I was scratching my head wondering, what was all this hubris about? The food was beautiful and beautifully arranged, but it was so expensive. And I sort of was trying to understand, why would I want to pay more for something that contains less pesticide? Why would I want to pay more money for to get something less harmful? It didn't make any sense to me. And so I actually, I think instinctively rejected it on principle. But because I'm a scientist, I look at data. And data, you know, is what allows scientists to change their mind. Because don't forget, the world was flat once, right?
Yes.
Meat grew flies, or you know, all these ideas that changed our knowledge. And what actually is quite remarkable to me is the series of discoveries that have been coming out over the last few years, only over the last few years, by horticulturalists who are studying the differences between pesticide-treated fruits and plants that we use for food, like tea and coffee and strawberries, just as a few examples, compared to the ones that are grown organically. Organically, you know, there's a formal definition, a governmental regulatory definition of organic, but for the purposes of, I think, our listeners, you know, it's sort of, do you grow with pesticides or do you grow it not with pesticides? And the pesticides we're talking about, of course, are the artificial ones, synthetic pesticides, the ones that are actually quite effective, but they wind up depositing residue in our food too. And most of us don't want that kind of residue in our body. Okay. So I said I was not willing to pay more to have less bad stuff. However, the research has shown that the bioactives that are found in coffee beans, tea leaves, strawberries, as three examples, actually serve a purpose for the plant. So in the wild, when strawberries are growing in the woods, like, you know, the what do they call them? The fruits de bois, you know, Yeah, exactly. They actually make a lot of this natural bioactive called ellagic acid. Okay. And ellagic acid, which is so good for us, it activates our metabolism, helps burn down harmful body fat, activates our circulation, and it can even protect against, can starve cancers as well. So really powerful stuff. That chemical, natural chemical, is made by the strawberry as a response to wound healing of the plant. Okay, now I'm also a wound healing researcher, so I know a lot about wound healing. So think, what does wound healing in a plant mean? All right, you've got a plant growing in a wild, naturally, and you've got, in the warm weather, little bugs that are nibbling on the leaves and the stems. That is an injury, right? That's like the paper cut or the scraped knee of a strawberry plant. And what the strawberry does in response to that injury is produce more ellagic acid. So with bugs, okay, with natural insects and the ecology of the ecosystem, nibbling on the leaves, which might not make the leaves or stems look very pretty, but actually it makes the berry itself much more potent for ellagic acid. That's what you get when you don't use pesticides and grow organically. You get more of the good stuff that the plant naturally produces in response to nature, which are have little bugs and things nibbling on the leaves and the stems. When you actually compare it to pesticide treated berries, teas, coffees, sure, there are fewer pests for the farmers to see, okay? And maybe the plants look a little bit nicer, but they actually also contain lower levels because the plant's not injured, not wounded. Okay, now, and this has been, by the way, quantified very, very specifically in the lab to look at how much more. You know how much more ellagic acid is a wild, a organically grown strawberry will have?
Yeah.
Three times more ellagic acid. We're not talking about 20% more. We're talking about three times more ellagic acid. Okay, so, you know, your response is my response. Wow.
Yeah.
Now I go back to challenge myself. Am I willing to pay more to have less pesticides? No. But am I willing to pay more to have more good stuff, three times more good stuff? And now I'm more open to it. Now, it's true, not everyone can afford organic foods. And so I don't mean to say that, you know, people should break their own bank and go beyond what they can afford. But I wanted to say, as a scientist, this is what we're discovering. I wish that growers of fruits and vegetables that are found in the marketplace, whether it's a European marketplace or whether it's a grocery store, you know, traditional market, village marketplace or a grocery store, what I wish that we would do as a society is pay more attention to those interactions between nature and our food, because that then will influence the benefits of the interaction between our food and our bodies.
I love what you're saying there. And I love the fact that you say that it doesn't have to necessarily be organic, but for instance, it can be a wild grown plant or a plant that you've just, a food that you've just grown in your garden without use of pesticides. It doesn't have to be sort of, you know, certified organic. By, for instance, in the UK, the Soil Association certifies organic. But as long as you know that there hasn't been all this added stuff growing, you know, to help it grow, you know that you're getting something with a bit more value. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is nature speaking out loud. And I think that, you know, as our planetary awareness improves, increases, because it has to increase, you know, with everything that's happening around in the world, one of the things that we realize is that, by the way, these foods actually become better for us the better we take care of our planet. And by the way, those bioactives also help the food taste more intensely of the flavor, because the flavors also intensify.
Right? I agree. I've been saying this about organic food for many years and people have not listened. Maybe people like you who thought, well, you know, what's the difference? Why would I pay more to have something that's just not had pesticides thrown on it, you know? But I've always said it tastes better and you don't have to have as much. And I agree with you. Not everybody can afford to go completely organic in their diet, but just some things, and some of the things that are the worst offenders, maybe swap over to, and you'll notice the difference in taste. And you'll notice, for me, how you feel after you've eaten them.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree.
Yeah. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming over from the dark side to the organic side.
Well, look, I mean, you know, it's all based on principle, right? Like, I mean, I think a lot of people with the marketing of organic was on principle. Let's not have pesticide laced food. Yeah, I don't want that either. But, you know, I always look for the reason to believe, and I'm willing to invest in my health. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And I'm always drawn towards the positive signaling, and I'm always sort of sitting back and maybe a little skeptical, cynical about the negative messaging out there. And when it comes to food and health and metabolism, fighting, especially dieting, you know, and this is why I wrote an anti-diet book.
Yeah.
Is look, these are artificial constructs that are designed to, you know, have help people aim towards something. But where does the science, what does the science say about it? And what we're talking about today is really about the science.
Absolutely. And I think it's great that the science has shown that there is a huge difference, really. So Yeah, that is wonderful. Now, we go from talking about organics to let's talk just a little bit more about the Mediterranean diet that you talk about in your book. Now, we talked about that in the previous conversation that we had, but I wonder if you could go into it a little bit more deeply. And you talked a little bit about the history of it, but I'd love to hear you talking a bit more about the Silk Road and, you know, how these foods came into our life, and so therefore why they're also good for us, right?
Yeah. Well, listen, the beating heart of my book and really my inspiration for it is my love of really delicious, tasty food. I'm a foodie and I like to cook as well. And one of the things that I had wanted to do in my previous book that I got to do in this one, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is to take people, my readers, on a tour with me through the grocery store, through the market.
Yeah.
And the way that I wrote about it is as if you were sitting in the grocery cart like you did when, like we all did when we were kids in our mom's grocery cart. And this time I'm wheeling you around, whispering in your ear what to put into the cart that's good for your health, good for your metabolism, helps you fight excess body fat, and avert chronic disease. So, the thing that I found so amazing about these ingredients, because it's really about ingredients, is that first, these ingredients, as I wrote about them, and each chapter is sort of the produce section, the middle aisles, the seafood section, the beverages, things that everyone will recognize, is when as I was writing about it, I realized there was this deep history.
Well, we'll hear more about that in just a moment, but first it's time to hear these messages from our station sponsors. Back with Dr. William Lee after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest, Dr. William Lee, who was telling us about the Silk Road origin of our everyday foods.
Carrots were long bred in the soil, and they actually came from southwestern Asia. Gosh, who would have thought that carrots actually came from southwestern Asia? And what was amazing is that the original carrots weren't orange, as we always see.
Right.
Yeah. They were originally purple. Beautiful purple, and he broke an original carrot. Oh, and you can still find these heirloom carrots, by the way. Purple carrot open. If I had had a demo today, I would have actually gotten one to shown you. When you break it open, it's bright yellow on the inside. Okay, and it wasn't until the 1600s that the Dutch farmers bred the carrot to become orange. And so, one of the things that there's this history of food. Onions, where do they come from? Apples and pears, where did they come from? Pears, by the way, came from Western China, from the Tian Shan Mountains. And around the same area the apples came from as well. Okay, and what about tomatoes? Tomatoes are actually used in Asian cooking now. But how did they get into Asia? Well, they came from Latin America, through South America, all the way up into Europe by explorers and traders. And then from Europe, they spread all the way to Asia. They were not flown to Asia, and they wouldn't survive they weren't shipped by boat to Asia because sailing passage was so precious in terms of the space, but they were transferred through trading routes. and trading routes on the Silk Road. It's like 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. There was this series of trails, like hiking trails, as it were, mm-hmm. that connected Asia, almost from the coast of Asia, all the way to Europe, Constantinople, all the way up into Greece, and even into Italy, to Venice, right? And so, and these are sort of lost in the passages of time. But these hiking trails were trader routes, and it was called the Silk Road. And yes, silk was indeed traded between China and the West. I mean, it was sort of one perspective of calling it a Silk Road. In fact, the people on camelback with all these goods to sell to other countries, other nations, other peoples, were also exchanging recipes, also exchanging ingredients, encountering new ingredients that were fresh along the trail. And they ate each other's food, which I think is a really amazing thing. And so the concept that I wrote about Mediterranean, because that's my answer to when somebody asked me, Dr. Lee, how do you eat? And I had to come up with like a one word answer, because and my answer is, wow, I eat Mediterranean style, because my background is Asian and I've lived in the Mediterranean and I naturally gravitate to those two things. But as I looked and thought more deeply about it, wow, there is this huge history in our, and in, you know, sort of human history of these two nations, these two areas actually cross-fertilizing and cross-pollinating each other. On top of that, think about these so-called blue zones, you know, that the National Geographic writer Dan Buettner talks about. I know Dan quite well. And the idea of blue zones, where are they found? They are found in Asia and they're found in the Mediterranean. Amazing. It's healthy, traditional food cultures, mostly plant-based, but using fresh ingredients and not exclusively plant-based. I mean, that's the other thing that's really quite amazing. Look, people that were eating on this Silk Road, they had fresh foods along the route, but there's a lot of desert in between there as well, a lot of rugged terrain. And so they carried with them dried, preserved, fermented foods as well. In fact, sauerkraut, which I always associate with German food, Eastern European food, actually came from China.
And it
was cabbage. Yeah, cabbage, which is very commonly used in Chinese cooking, was shredded up, and they wanted to actually bring it with them on the Silk Road. It would never survive fresh cabbage. Right. So they fermented it. You ferment cabbage, and it turns into kraut. Sauerkraut.
Well, see, I mean, it makes sense when you think of kimchi in Korea, right? But I've never associated sauerkraut with China. Like you, I would say Germany or somewhere. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's part of the amazing things that I got to do in writing the food section of the book. And I hope my readers will also sort of delight in discovering new aspects of foods that they didn't realize. By the way, I'll tell you another like really bizarre fact that I was able to discover. For my research, I've been very privileged to travel to some remote corners of the world that many people may not have been to. And I was exploring seafood because marine omega-3 fatty acids are so important. Now in Scotland, you know, you can actually get some really nice fresh seafood from the North Sea and other places like that, mm-hmm. right? Okay. But if you want to go to the world's great seafood markets, you want to go to Barcelona. You want to go to Tokyo, the Tsukiji fish market. You want to go to Hong Kong, where you see all this amazing seafood. I mean, the diversity of seafood, the likes of which most people have never seen. So I've been able to see all this stuff. And I found an interesting, delicious seafood. It's a relative of a shrimp. It's actually sort of between a shrimp and a lobster. It's called a mantis shrimp, and it's very colorful. In fact, if you're an aquarist, you might actually keep one because it's beautiful. But these little shrimpy lobstery guys, it's called a mantis shrimp because their arms are folded up like a praying mantis.
Okay.
They for them to capture their prey, they can punch out with their claw the speed of a bullet. Wow. And in fact, they punch out so fast, they create a cavitation bubble in front of their claw to knock off the other claws of crabs and other things that they're eating. And it hits the prey with the force of a torpedo from a submarine hitting a ship. So anyway, yeah. if you want to read about really cool stuff that I thought was so amazing about food, get Eat to Beat Your Diet. I really just try to put as many historical things and a lot of like, I wanted to have fun and I wanted my readers to really have fun about it as well. Cause food is not about simply sustenance.
Food is
really about appreciation. And I wanted to actually write about that.
I completely agree. I must have missed the mantis shrimp bit, but certainly there are other things in there which I absolutely adored. I'll go back and read it again. But then what's also important is when and how we eat, isn't it? So I'm talking here a little bit about fasting. Talk to me a bit. Talk to us about fasting.
Such a great question. It's almost certain that anyone listening to this now has heard of intermittent fasting because it's been covered by the media. Friends and family might be practicing intermittent fasting. It's a trend. It's a fad. It's being written about online and in print, and people are talking about it on YouTube. It's hard to ignore intermittent fasting. And what I really try to do is just first tell you that there is a lot about intermittent fasting in my book, but I don't make a big deal about it, that concept of intermittent fasting. I do believe in it, but here I want everyone to understand intermittent fasting is not a made up concept. It's the most natural concept to our bodies. When we wake up, we eat during the day, usually three to five times actually, we encounter food. And then when we sleep, we're not eating, it's called fasting. And when we get up in the morning and we start our eating again, we're breaking our fast, which is why we call the first meal of the day breakfast, break fast. So there's really, we've had to come with a concept of something that's so natural to our bodies. But what I explain in my book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is that there's something quite profound and science-backed about intermittent fasting. What happens to our body when we're eating and what happens to our body when we're not eating? Both can actually be really good for us. So first, let's talk about when you're eating, i.e. not fasting. If you understand what happens there, it becomes more, you can appreciate better what happens when you're fasting. All right. So during the day, when you and I are eating, JJ, we are putting food in our mouth. The moment food goes in our mouth, our pancreas creates insulin. Insulin is part of our metabolism and helps our bodies draw in the energy, the fuel from the food that we're eating to power up our body. That's how our metabolism works. And because that's such an important concept of eating and storing that fuel and using that energy, our metabolism's completely focused on storing energy. Ha, we got some food. Let's get that energy in. Let's store it up. The body, it's like filling up your gas tank in a petrol station. You're getting what you need. You're fueling up. Okay. Now, when we're not eating, what happens is that our insulin levels go down. No food, no energy, no need to have insulin. And when you talk about insulin spikes, people get really, really concerned about insulin spikes. It's really over the course of a day how elevated your insulin is. Spikes can matter, but it's sort of net how high is it going over the course of a day. But here's the deal. When we're not eating, our insulin levels decline naturally. Don't need to make any more of it because you don't have food. And when our insulin levels decline, our body, our metabolism shifts gears. Okay. Just like us in a standard car, you're shifting into a completely different gear. And the gear our metabolism shifts in when we're not eating, our insulin levels are low. This is what happens when we're fasting or sleeping, as it were. Now our metabolism can shift into fuel burning mode. We can burn down that fuel that was stored. So think about it. When you pull over to the filling station to fill up your car with gas, you turn off your engine. Don't burn anymore. Come on, you're just filling it up. When you actually are done filling up your tank, i.e. done eating or done filling up your tank, you can actually turn in your car and drive off. And now you're burning the fuel. Same situation in our bodies. So when we're fasting, we're burning fuel. Where is that fuel coming from? Well, it's what we accumulated during the day, maybe the day before, maybe the weekend before, maybe from the holidays, we've been storing up more and more and more fuel. Yeah. So much, we live in a time of abundance. And so many of us overeat. And that's a problem because we've got way too much fuel in our body and we can't burn it off efficiently. But if you think about the balance, the homeostasis, the equilibrium that we're aiming for, we want to have, kind of like a fuel tank that is needs to be filled up every now and then, but it's not overloaded. And so when we're fasting, our body, our metabolism is burning fuel. We're burning down fuel from our fat, stored in our fat, from our harmful fat. When we're sleeping and we're fasting, because we're not eating, we're burning extra fuel. And that is why intermittent fasting, which is so natural, we all do it every single day, actually is metabolically beneficial and can help us prime our metabolism, help us fight harmful body fat. And then there's ways of tweaking it. So this is sort of like the when we eat, like the how we eat, by the way, just to address that. How we eat, if you gobble your food and you really kind of like wolf your food down, you're so easy to overload your fuel tank, too much food. When you overload your metabolism, that fuel's got to be stored someplace. It will be stored in your fat. So you will grow your body fat. When your body fat grows, it becomes inflamed, okay? When you have inflamed fat, it disrupts all these other parts of your ecosystem and your body and sets up for chronic disease. So that's why we don't want to overload our fuel. But one of the things, so that's the how, is like not to overeat and not to take too much food. I say quit the clean plate club in America, which is don't feel like you have to do what the schoolmistress said, which is to eat every drop on your plate, okay? The idea though is that, so then when do you eat? Here, I'll tell you what I do. And I write about in this book because I think it's pretty practical. First, if you study what people are saying about intermittent fasting, they're like, it's called 16 and 8. You got to fast for 16 hours and only eat within 8 hours. I sit there and I scratch my head. How can I structure my day to eat only in 8 hours? That's going to be difficult for me. I might be able to do it on a weekend but it's too difficult for most people. And if you're one of those people who really has enormous discipline and you can actually make that work, go for it. Fasting for 16 hours actually gives you a lot of time where you're not eating and your body can burn down fuel and improve your metabolism. But for me, it's just not practical. So the research actually shows, and this is what I do, that if you get 8 hours of sleep, let's say you go to bed at 11 o'clock, just as just an example, and you get 8 hours, you're going to wake up at 7. All right. So as an example, that's 8 hours. Now, the night before you eat dinner, for the sake of argument, say you're going to eat dinner at 7 o'clock. You sit down for dinner at 7, eat for an hour. I'm not talking about an Italian or a Spanish or a Greek meal, you know, that lasts for hours.
Yeah.
Let's say that you eat practically for an hour. You put your dishes away. You eat at 7. You put your dishes away at 8 o'clock. All right. And now don't eat after that. When your dishes go away, no more food. All right. No midnight snacking. Don't sit and telephone. Don't get that extra scoop of ice cream. You're done. Okay. And when you're done, let's say at 8 o'clock, your dishes are away, 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock when you go to bed, that's 3 extra hours you have with low insulin. Metabolism can switch to fat burning. That extra 3 hour adds to your 8 hours. Now you got 11 hours instantly just by not snacking after dinner. And then what I do when I get up in the morning, I don't do what my mom used to tell me to do, which is hurry up, get breakfast, and get on the school bus so you can get to school in time. What I actually do is I take my time getting ready, you know, take a shower, I get dressed, and I might go for a walk, I might check my emails, I might read something. It's usually about 1 hour before I decide to eat anything. And it's a habit that, you know, that I have now, but it's all about habits anyway. You know, people sitting down and wolfing a breakfast down. Wait an hour. Now, guess what? 3 hours the night before, 8 hours of sleep, 11 hours, plus 1 extra hour, it's 12 hours. There's 24 hours in a day. And now half of my day is allowing my body to burn down extra fuel for my metabolism. And by the way, I've actually measured the effectiveness of doing this using a little breathalyzer device. It's called the Lumen. And, you know, I think it's really amazing too that our technology, you know, we live in a technology world. This is not a wearable. This is actually a little handheld device you can put on your desk. And literally you train it. And it's like a breathalyzer. Instead of the trooper, you know, the policeman pulling you over to the side of the road to ask how much alcohol you had, it's something you can do in the morning to test your metabolism and see how much fat burning your body's actually doing. And so when I do this pattern that I have, which is 12 and 12, 12 eating, meaning 12 fat fuel loading and 12 not eating, fuel burning, my metabolism like is off the charts good. It actually, I always like ace out that the meter. So I'm just telling you, like, this works. Human studies show that you can actually lose weight even with 12 hours. Sure, you go to 16, you're going to get a little bit more benefit, but it's less sustainable. So I always say, again, back to the individual, do what's going to work for you. Do what's reasonable for you to do. Everyone's life is going to be different. But I always say, try to do something that's sustainable, because health is something that you want your entire life, not just for a few weeks.
That's a great perspective on intermittent fasting, isn't it? And just as a side note, my father always pronounced breakfast as breakfast, and you can still hear Scots pronouncing it that way today. Time for another break right now, though. Back with more from Dr. Lee right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E by God.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio, with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guest, Dr. William Lee, whose new book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is out now and well worth reading. Moving on from fasting to another natural way of boosting your metabolism, something regular listeners will know I'm a big fan of, and that's cold water swimming.
Well, first of all, swimming is one of, I mean, I'll just speak as a physician.
Yeah.
Swimming is one of the healthiest exercises we can do because it's aerobic. There's a little bit of resistance naturally against the pull of the water. Okay. And so aerobic resistance training is hard to get other, you know, in almost any other context. And it actually doesn't put any load or weight bearing on our joints, particularly as we get older. That's one of the things that we worry about. You know, you could be a runner when you're much younger, but when you get into your midlife and older, you know, that crunch, crunch, crunch on your yeah. knees and your hips becomes harder and harder. Even playing tennis, which could be really enjoyable, becomes a little harder because every time you hit that ball, you have joint against joint. And so swimming is one of these things which, you know, if you look at a dolphin and see how graceful a dolphin moves through the water, that's really, I think, a perfect image to think about how naturally our body is designed to move without stress. So the stress or the strain or the stress or the workout that you get swimming is really aerobic. It's about your muscles. It's about resisting. And it also trains you how to breathe better. And that's another thing that I think that swimming actually does. So for all these reasons, swimming is good. Now, let's talk about cold water swimming. Okay. Now, I'm sure when we were all kids, we did not want to go to the beach in the middle of the winter and go in our bathing suits and plunge into that cold water.
Oh, no.
I mean, leave that for the like the Norwegian politicians, whatever they do, you know, as part of the rituals, right?
Yeah.
But I will tell you that as it turns out, that this idea of cold plunges are quite remarkably good for you, and the science is actually showing why. And here is actually why. Our body is designed, it's all about our body at the end of the day. Our body is designed to keep us warm. We have a core temperature You really want to keep yourself as warm as possible. That's why we shiver, you know, shivering to try to keep us warm. But we have a special way of actually keeping warm as well. And it's called our brown fat. So not all fat is bad. In fact, all fat is good until you have too much of it. But brown fat is different than the lumpy, bumpy, wiggly, jiggly stuff under your arm and under your chin. Brown fat is paper thin and it's plastered around our neck, behind our breastbone, under our arms, a little bit in our back, a little bit in our belly. And actually in cold temperatures, and this has been studied in Scandinavia, where it's generally colder most of the year, outdoor workers have a lot of this brown fat. And what does the brown fat do? It generates heat. It generates heat to keep our core temperature warm, but it also generates heat to help to right size our metabolism. So when we are in a cold plunge or swimming in cold water, that cold temperature elicits a response from our brain, norepinephrine, which is kind of a response to cold, you know, the plunging of cold water in the body, basically will release and it goes down the nerves and it activates the brown fat. And you know what it does in the brown fat? It actually turns on the space heater function. The brown fat fires up energy, okay, and it warms up. And the analogy I give is this. This is a little torch and it's firing up. And this is what cold water does. It actually fires up this torch. Now, where's the fuel coming from? If this is brown fat, where is this fuel coming from that will fire this up? It is drawing that fuel from your harmful white fat. So now cold temperatures fire up your brown fat. And now your brown fat is drawing down the fuel from the fat you don't want. And so that fat you don't want starts to shrink and burn away. This is when, and when that fat, the harmful fat burns away, your metabolism starts to rise. Okay, so this is actually one of the reasons to explain the health benefits, the true health benefits, bona fide, scientifically shown health benefits of cold water plunges, swimming in cold water. Look, not everyone is lucky enough to have, you know, a beautiful loch to swim in like you do. Yeah. But the bottom line is that, you know, check it out online. People are showing you how to do it. Make sure you do it safely. By the way, just as a doctor, I'll say one additional thing. Cold water can be a shock to the system. So people who might have cardiovascular conditions, former heart condition, rhythm conditions, you know, things like that. Please talk to your doctor before trying to do anything that is might be considered extreme. You don't want to actually do a shock to your body that way. It may be medically not indicated. I can't give medical advice here, but this is where, again, people shouldn't just jump onto trends, but know that this cold water trend actually has some real scientific merit.
No, thank you for saying that. And thank you for giving that caveat there, because I always say to people, whatever you do, just don't. If you've never been in the sea or a loch or a river before, don't just jump in the middle of winter, because it can be a terrible shock to the system. And the last thing you want to do is to go into shock, right? Especially in cold weather. So everybody, please, please be careful about that. And for that reason as well, I don't swim in the winter on my own. I will always have somebody with me. So just to make sure, because you never know what's going to happen. You don't want to go into hypothermia or anything like that. So,
And you also don't want to go into cold water that's too cold. Just remember that last scene in the Titanic.
Oh, no. That's terrible. I'm going to have that in my brain all day now. That's awful. But no, you're right, though. You are right. And so, I mean, we've gone over some of the things that I really wanted to go over. And just one final thing that I wanted to talk about, because we are getting not there yet, but we're getting, you know, this is probably the last thing we'll have time to talk about. So we're talking about really a natural diet in many ways, a diet that's historically proven to be healthy and, you know, enhancing our lives and our metabolism. And we're talking about all these natural things that we can do that we've maybe moved away from because of our industrialized lives. The one thing that there's been a lot of research into in recent years, which hasn't up until, I don't know, you know, sort of recent decades been thought much about, and that's the gut biome. Now, the microbiome is very important. So, and you do touch on that as well. So maybe we can talk just a little bit about that before we have to end this conversation.
Yeah, well, most people have heard of gut health, and gut health today is really based on our modern understanding of the gut microbiome. The microbiome is simply put, the bacteria, the healthy bacteria that lives in our body. And when I was in medical school many years ago, I can tell you we had zero understanding of the microbiome. In fact, we barely knew anything about it. You know, the bacteria in our gut was in our poop, you know, and that's it. And if you had bacteria in your gut, we have to treat it with antibiotics to kill those bad bugs. Man, were we wrong.
Yeah.
Our bacteria, so the human body is made of about 40 trillion cells. And that's more than the stars you can see in the sky on a clear night. Okay. And we have about 39 trillion, almost the same number of healthy bacteria that lives inside us. And most of it's in our gut. So we are one to one, one part human, one part bacteria. And the bacteria lives mostly in our gut. It's also in our skin and orifices, but most of it's in our gut. Where in the gut, and JJ, in case your listeners don't know where in the gut, it is in the tail end of the gut. So the gut starts in the mouth and it ends at the tailpipe, so to speak, the anus. Yeah. And the colon is the last major section of our intestines. And the colon is sort of like this big, it's like the Arc de Triomphe. Okay. It's an upside down U.
Yeah.
All right. And the ascending part of it on one limb going up to the top actually is kind of baggy, and it's called the cecum, C-E-C-U-M. The cecum, which is sort of the shopping bag part of the colon, in this 40-foot long intestines, actually is where most of the gut microbiome, mostly healthy gut bacteria, live. Now, what's the idea of the gut microbiome? And I always sort of try to take people into a visual or some analogy, so it's something they can relate to. Think about the gut microbiome at like the Great Barrier Reef. It is this amazing system of different beautiful organisms that live close, right next door to each other and support each other and do good things for the ocean. And so too is our gut microbiome, all these bacteria that live together in our cecum, in our gut, that actually not only support each other to be healthier, but together in totality, our gut microbiome supports our health. Now, this is where it becomes important. What do they do for human health when they are functioning in a healthy way? When the ecosystem is healthy, right? When the Great Barrier Reef is healthy, what does it do for the human body? Well, quite importantly, the gut microbiome releases particles called short-chain fatty acids. These are metabolites from the bacteria that lower inflammation in our body. So, you know, we take anti-inflammatories or steroids and all this kind of stuff. You know that our gut microbiome naturally releases these anti-inflammatory substances, all right? So we really need to take care of our gut because inflammation is the root cause of so many different illnesses. Number two, our gut microbiome affects our mood and our behavior so profoundly. It turns out that our gut microbiome, these bacteria send text messages to our brain, or you want to use WhatsApp messages to our brain. And what happens is that our brain receives these messages. You know, there are nerves that connect our brain to the rest of our body, mm-hmm. including our gut. Remarkably, now we know that the gut sends messages back to the brain. We used to think it was a one-way street. Now we know messages go back up. What are those messages? The text messages, the WhatsApps from the bacteria go back to the brain. And when the bacteria send those messages, the brain will release social hormones. What are they? Dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. Look, these are the things that therapists and psychiatrists always think about when they're working with a patient for a mood disorder. You want to be in a better mood. Oh, we need to have more serotonin. Dopamine is a feel-good hormone. Oxytocin, by the way, I don't think we've talked about this before. Oxytocin is the social hormone. It is a hormone that connects the mom and baby. When the baby first comes up to take the first suckle of breast milk, it's a huge surge of oxytocin that comes out to the mom and the baby, and also helps the milk get into the baby's mouth through the breast ducts. The other thing that oxytocin does that's amazing is it's a social hormone that connects us with our friends and our family. Mm-hmm. So when you actually go to the airport to see a friend you haven't seen in a long time, and they come through the customs gate or the arrivals, and you run up and give them a hug, and it feels so great. Your brain is releasing oxytocin, and that's why you feel so good. Oxytocin also comes out of your brain when you have a kiss, not a peck on the cheek, but a French kiss, mm-hmm. a deep kiss. oxytocin comes out. And then the best example that everyone will remember is oxytocin floods out of our brains for just a few seconds when we have an orgasm. So this is controlled by our gut bacteria. You want to keep your gut bacteria healthy. Gut bacteria, by the way, besides your mood and how we feel, or well, feeling of well-being, besides our lower inflammation, also controls our immune system. Good gut health, better immunity. All right. Nobody needs to be taught after what we went through in the last few years, important it is to have good immunity. Mm. And immunity, by the way, is not just about bacteria and viruses. That's important for sure. But I will tell you, as a cancer researcher, the strength of our immunity is so important for preventing and fighting the existence of cancers, whether it's microscopic cancer or existing cancer in our body. When our immune system goes down, cancers can escape and start to actually grow throughout our bodies. So if you want to be cancer-free, primary protection, prevention, secondary prevention, you want to help your oncologist treat your cancer, please recognize your immune system is its own natural response to fight, to battle cancer. We need that. And the gut bacteria is connected to that as well. Having said all that, you know, it's easy to see how wrong my medical school professors were in saying must write prescription to kill bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And on that note, we've come to the end, but I am so grateful to you for coming back on the show and talking more about all of this. You give such wonderful information, and your book, Eat to Beat Your Diet, is absolutely well worth everybody reading, because there is so much more in there that everybody will find beneficial for their lives and their good health, and also their eating delight, if I may say so. So, Dr. Lee, thank you so, so much for everything today. Here's to good eating, I think.
Thank you. And I'll just close by saying that, you know, one of the take-home messages from my book is that it's time to rediscover the joy of food and align that joy with our joy of health.
I love it. The two certainly go hand in hand for me. Great to have Dr. William Lee back on the show. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Now, remember, you can listen to our shows on all the main podcast platforms these days. It can be as easy as just asking Siri or Alexa to play UK Health Radio if you have either of those. And if you appreciate our shows, or if they've helped you, do help us spread the word by liking and sharing them. You never know, it might just be what somebody you know needs to hear. Also, check out the show I co-host with psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston here on UK Health Radio. It's called Hurt Less, Live More, and it's the place for some raw, open, uplifting and hopefully enlightening conversations with fantastic guests. For even more health information, there's our sister publication, Health Triangle magazine. That's a monthly magazine that's full of great features complementing our radio shows. And you can subscribe online at ukhealthradio.com. And that really is all for today. Join me again for more Alchemy 101. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.